on the next uprising, the Sutherland Springs Massacre, and gun control. Could anything have helped? We'll get into it.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president! Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
I have never met with Russians.
Putin is continuing to advance into
Korea.
Gee, it's amazing that the Russians have been able to influence four special elections.
Welcome back to another edition of The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. This is Scott Cosenza, and joined by Nathan Steelwater, and happy Veterans Day, first of all, Nathan.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And the genesis of this podcast is both my knowledge and your knowledge of guns and gun control in the country and the unfortunate massacre at the Sutherland Springs, Texas church. And so I wanted to start off and say, if anybody didn't know, gun did the killer, and I choose not to use his name just in case he wanted the publicity. What gun did the killer use in Sutherland Springs, and how did he purchase it?
So my understanding is that the gun used by the Sutherland Springs killer was a Ruger AR-556, so essentially it's an M4 variant made by Ruger. That type of platform of rifle is one of the most popular of that caliber that's sold in the country. It looks similar to, you know, the military-style M4.
And by M4, for people who don't know, we're talking about in civilian terms, it's an AR-15, is that right?
Yes, exactly. So an AR-15 is the civilian equivalent to the military's M4, with the exception that AR-15s are only semi-automatic, whereas the military M4 has a 3-round burst option.
And how did Mr. the
So again, from my understanding, is that he bought it at a gun shop, like most people would. You know, went through the instant background check that would happen, and no red flags came up, and was able to purchase that firearm.
Okay, so the killer used his AR-15 assault rifle to murder these people, and what about the man, Mr. Williford, who is our hero in this story, who helped stop the massacre from proceeding in an even more deadly fashion? What firearm did he use?
So while I haven't been able to find the specific brand and model, it was an AR-15 platform as well.
All right, so much for the idea that these are not used in positive ways as well, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes back to pretty much the standard comment that a lot on the right will say about guns, is that in and of themselves, they're fairly neutral, and it's how you use them that really makes it good or bad. You know, the AR-15 platform is used for home defense. It's used for sporting and target practice. It's also used for hunting as well. Has a wide variety of uses.
Yeah, one of the hunting sort of things is that I find just laughable when I hear so many commenters in the mainstream media or legacy media is they refer to it as a high-powered rifle. And in many, or at least several jurisdictions in the United States, one cannot hunt with a traditionally chambered 223 or 5.56 AR-15 because it's not powerful enough. It's not actually a high-powered rifle, is it?
So when we get into that conversation, the argument is less over the power of the rifle and more of the bullet themselves. Ballistics has a large role to play. So, for instance, an AR-15 chambered in 5.56 will have less punch than an AR-15 chambered in 7.62 by 39. They both look exactly the same. One just fires a larger bullet with a different powder charge. So AR-15s, and specifically the 5.56 round, it's high velocity. It is a supersonic round. However, depending on the powder package that you get, the power behind that will really change. It's not going to leave, you know, a massive exit wound. In many cases, it won't leave an exit wound at all. It's one of the reasons that people like to use a 5.56 for home defense because it's not going to punch through a lot of walls, and especially some of your harder core walls if you have concrete homes.
Right.
Over, depending on how much powder is behind it.
Helps with the problem of potential over-penetration.
Right, exactly. So, for instance, I have several hunting rifles, and they have a single caliber, you know, and that's just how wide of a bullet they take. But I can take several different types of grain, which is the term used, to determine how much gunpowder puts that bullet out. And depending on that different grain count will determine, you know, the ballistics of that individual round, how hard it will hit, how far it will go, the type of penetration it has. You know, it's all about the grain and the bullet itself. Ballistics doesn't really matter about the rifle. It matters about what you're shooting with.
Okay, Nathan, let's turn now to the actual purchase of the murder weapon, if we could, which you discussed it at length on LibertyNation.com on your piece about the Air Force's and federal government's mismanagement of SAME. And can you tell us, so there were two issues that have been presented in the news that people seem to think may or should have prevented this killer from acquiring the gun. One is his discharge status, and the other is his criminal conviction for being an abuser of his wife and child. So let's take the discharge status if we could. Was he dishonorably discharged, and what about how that might have prevented him from getting a gun?
Sure. So he was actually not dishonorably discharged. He received what's called a bad conduct discharge. And while these may sound similar, they carry with them some distinctions. Excuse me, I got a kid in the background. They carry with them some distinctions. So a bad conduct discharge is received basically through a court-martial. You lose all of your veterans' benefits. However, it's not considered like a felony. So some states will consider a dishonorable discharge the same that they will a felony, in so much as civil rights forfeiture and stuff like that. Dishonorable discharges come from, again, a court-martial, but for things that specify that you get a dishonorable discharge. For instance, desertion, like in the Bo Bergdahl case.
Okay, so it was less than the most serious I don't know if the word serious is the right word, but the most offensive of discharges. And that's why it didn't prevent him from getting it. Is that right?
Correct. So a dishonorable discharge automatically prevents you from being able to purchase a firearm. And that's part of your record. You know, when that instant background check or the whatever background check your individual state uses when you purchase a firearm, that red flag will come up. You won't be able to get one. However, a bad conduct discharge, while it carries about 99% of the same penalties as a dishonorable, you don't automatically forfeit the civil rights that you would with a dishonorable discharge, in this case, firearm purchase.
Let's move to then the abuse conviction itself. And for that, I just want to kind of give a little bit of a primer on the Lautenberg Amendment, as it's colloquially referred to, or the domestic violence offender gun ban. And this was a law that was passed in 1997. And basically what it did was it said that anybody who was convicted of spousal abuse as a misdemeanor, they had their firearm rights restricted or removed. And the reason why it specified a misdemeanor is because felons do not have the same firearm rights as the rest of us do. Their rights are already removed and restricted by the basis of their conviction. And one of the things that was a real problem with the Lautenberg Amendment, and one of the reasons why people like myself think that it was a horrible law, is when a person issues plea bargains, which is how most of our criminal justice affairs are settled in this country. It's not a trial, but it is, in fact, a plea bargain. Most of that is done, most of those cases are resolved through plea bargains. And the problem is that if you plea bargained your domestic violence case in 1995, for instance, and didn't know that a consequence was that you would lose all your firearm rights, well, you may not have chosen to accept that plea bargain. You may have wanted to go to court. But so this sort of violates, in my mind, a ban on ex post facto laws. But in any case, it was passed into law, and it has not been, and it is current law. And it says that if you have been convicted of a crime of domestic violence, you do lose your gun rights, and why didn't the killer here lose his gun rights? How was he still able to go and purchase a gun in spite of this law?
You know, Scott, that's a very good question, and that's the question that the Air Force's Inspector General is trying to answer. So the shooter received a court-martial for Article 128 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is assault. So the military doesn't have a specific charge for domestic violence, but those cases are tried under assault. So he received several convictions under that in military prison, reduction in rank all the way to E1, so the lowest you can go, and then the bad conduct discharge. Now, what's supposed to happen is that conviction, which is a qualifying conviction under the Lautenberg Amendment, and the one point is that the military doesn't really specify between felony and misdemeanor, but this court-martial conviction is a qualifying conviction for the Lautenberg Amendment, so it counts for the Lautenberg. So what should have happened is that the Air Force officials, upon his discharge, or after the conviction, should have notified civilian authorities, specifically law enforcement authorities, so that it can go on the quote-unquote permanent record that we have with the FBI when they do those background checks. But because they didn't do that, for whatever reason, and that's what the IG is trying to find out, that information wasn't available. So when his background check went through, there was no red flag for the domestic violence, and there was nothing to prevent him from purchasing that firearm.
Is it fair to say that
there should have been?
Is it fair to say that a complete set of laws and regulations were in place to prevent this person from purchasing a firearm in the manner he did if those rules were followed by the authorities?
Absolutely. So if all of the policies and procedures that were already in effect had been followed correctly, he would not have been able to legally purchase a firearm.
Okay. So I think this is very important and something that so many of us who want to keep and bear arms and have society respect our right to keep and bear arms have been saying for really decades now, which is that the police and the prosecutors and everybody else are not using the laws that are already on the books. And why pile more laws on top of us that will restrict yours and my right to keep and bear arms when the laws that are already designed to help stop people like this from acquiring firearms are not being enforced? And look what the result is.
Yeah, you know, there's definitely a very good argument to make for that, because we have hundreds upon hundreds of gun control laws in this country. And in a lot of cases, there aren't the resources to, you know, actually utilize and follow them. You know, if we're not going to file the paperwork that has to be filed that would prevent a person like this from getting a firearm illegally, then what's even the point of having that law? Now, that's not a call to action to repeal those laws because, you know, some type of fatalist argument, but if we add more legislation, that's just another level of legislation that lackadaisical bureaucrats or, you know, more cracks that it's just going to fall through.
Mm-hmm. Is there a single piece of legislation that you would be in favor of that you think could be added to the body of federal laws that might help cut down on these instances of mass shootings that would not offend Second Amendment rights?
So, not really. There is maybe one slight alteration that I would do, and that's the Lautenberg Amendment as it stands now, from my understanding, basically only applies with the conviction if you're living with that person. So, you know, a spouse, something like that.
Your domestic partner.
It does not cover, to my understanding, domestic violence against basically like a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you know, someone that you're not
cohabitating
kind of legally
with, right?
Bound to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cohabitating with. Because one thing that we have seen with a lot of recent mass shooters is that there is, and again, correlation doesn't imply
sure.
causation, but there has been a connection of a history of domestic violence with a mass shooting. And so that is one thing that, you know, we can kind of look at on amending potentially that Lautenberg Amendment just to kind of include, hey, this was a misdemeanor charge for domestic violence, but you weren't married to the person, but it still meets the same intent. I understand your argument as far as ex post facto for the Lautenberg Amendment, and that's, you know, that's something that can be discussed. But with all the laws that we already have on the books, the only really things that we could do to maybe further prevent some of this is enforcing the laws that we already have and streamlining some of the process. You know, we don't really have reciprocity when it comes to, you know, healthcare for mental health issues. You know, I'm not saying, well, you know, people with mental health problems commit these crimes. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is that, you know, if you look at a lot of the mass shootings that happen that aren't, you know, politically motivated or actual terrorism, you know, it's usually a very troubled person who shouldn't really have gotten a firearm anyway, but because the system was broken down or because states don't communicate with each other, that information wasn't available. And so I think if we're going to do anything, we need to take the laws that we already have and make them actually functional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the record, I definitely would not be in favor of that expansion of the Lautenberg Amendment. And I think that it itself should be stricken from the law books because of the ex post facto nature of the punishment. And I think that if the federal government wants to remove people's firearm rights because of something they did, we have systems that are set up in place to do so. Let it be a federal crime and let them convict those people. If it's a fundamental right, I think that we need more than sort of a tack on to some local charge. But before we go, let me ask, did you happen to see the Feinstein proposed the assault weapons ban of 2017 that she introduced?
Yeah, you know, I was able to kind of skim over a little bit, and it's basically just a regurgitation of every attempt for an assault weapons ban that Feinstein and her ilk have tried, which is laughable.
I thought the laundry list was the hilarious part, that super long, hundreds-long list of guns.
Yeah, I mean, it was a, you know, several dozen-page list of, you know, anything, these guns or anything similar to them. And it's basically just a list of specific companies and models because legislation is going to go after private industry now, apparently. But, you know, the thing that's laughable about all this is that the term assault weapon didn't exist until the assault weapons ban of the 1990s. That did was change cosmetic features. You know, you look at some of the stuff that's in Feinstein's bill and you've got, you know, like a, you have a barrel shroud. Okay, well, you know, a barrel shroud is a thing that goes around the barrel to keep your hand from getting burned because metal gets hot. It's the same thing that you see, like, on a shotgun that's wood in some cases, you know. But then again, as far as Feinstein's concerned, things are the shoulder thing that goes up is...
right. My favorite is the bayonet lug because so many people in these massacres are dying as a result of bayoneting. I was speaking... with Tim earlier today from LibertyNation.com, and on his radio show, we were talking about, I liken the list to if we have more of these terrorists that are mowing people down in their vehicles, passing a law that says, like, okay, you can have a Honda Accord, but and you can't have a Honda Civic because that's the preferred vehicle of terrorist mow downs. It's about the same logic as far as I'm able to determine.
Well, the thing too is that, you know, assault weapons, even if we're going to entertain the term, you know, and really what they're talking about is just anything that's black and scary and looks like military guns from the movies. You know, those are the vast minority of gun deaths that happen in this country. The vast majority of them are with handguns, and the majority of those are suicides. You know, up until we changed the definition of what a mass shooting was a couple of years ago, to include when, you know, three or more people are shot, including the perpetrator, that's the only reason that we're able to report, oh, we have over 300 mass shootings in this country a year. But when you change the definition that a mass shooting is now, and I may be off by a number or so, but now it's three or more people shot, including the perpetrator.
Or shot,
any
yeah.
gang violence. Is,
right.
Yeah,
any sort of...
is now mass shooting.
Yeah, any...
I'm a cop, and I pull someone over, and my partner and I engaged the two people in the car because they shot at us and we shot back. Well, that's now a mass shooting.
Yeah, those statistics are without value for those of us who actually are trying to look for, you know, some method of understanding what's going on to the extent that there may be a path forward to stopping it, which I'm not sure that there is, but I know for sure that removing the currently protected firearm rights of nonviolent Americans is not the path forward.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, so for Nathan Steelwater, this is Scott Cosenza. Thanks for listening to The Uprising, and please check out more of Nathan's great work on LibertyNation.com. Bye.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president! Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
I have never met with Russians.
Putin is continuing to advance into Korea.
Gee, it's amazing that the Russians have been able to influence four special elections.